Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from Edvest and You, a loan product of the NEEF Network, a local nonprofit agency providing college student loans and student loan refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Sam Evans Brown, and this is The Exchange. percent of the land area of the entire United States is covered by lawns. That's more than is planted with cotton, oats, and sorghum combined. It's nearly as much acreage as is planted with wheat, which is a food that we eat, many of us, every day. Americans spend $30 billion a year tending to those lawns, 9 billion gallons of water a day irrigating, and 70 hours a year, that's nearly 2 weeks of vacation time, mowing. And fully 20% of Americans say that mowing their lawn is their least favorite chore. So, today on The Exchange, why do we do it? And what would happen if you gave yourself permission to be free from your lawn? I personally have seen the other side, and I'm here to tell you, life is better without lawnmowers. So why is there so much pressure to maintain a neatly trimmed putting green in your front yard? And what does it take physically, practically, to do things differently? We will talk specifics here on the show. Joining us right now is Henry Homeyer, UNH Master Gardener and author of 4 gardening books, including The New Hampshire Gardener's Companion, An Insider's Guide to Gardening in the Granite State. Henry has been writing a weekly gardening column for a dozen newspapers around New England for more than 20 years. Henry, thank you for being with us on The Exchange.
Good morning, and thank you for inviting me.
So Henry, I wonder if we could sort of talk more broadly. Why do we have lawns? Where does the lawn come from?
The lawn goes back to Europe, really, and rich manor houses had lawns around them and had people that they had cut the lawn with hand size or scythe, and it was a rich man's garden. But it became possible in the United States in the mid-1800s when the push mower came along, the rotary push mower, or reel mower, I guess it's called, and people started doing them for lots of reasons. One is that lawn is essentially a soothing landscape. And secondly, it's easier than trying to weed a flower garden that's everywhere. It takes less time. It's the quick and easy way to cover your landscape with something that's pleasant. And thirdly, or lastly, you can play games on it. You can play croquet, you can play badminton, throw a frisbee. A nice lawn is very appealing to Americans.
So you mentioned that hand scything great European estates. Can we talk a little bit more about that? What did it used to take to maintain that neatly kept grass in front of a manor?
Well, I wasn't there back then, but I know that they had full-time gardeners, sometimes 2 or 3, that would do nothing but maintain the property. That's expensive.
Right. So amazingly, I read last night when I was researching for the show that the first non-gas-powered push, you know, spinning blade mower, the type that you have seen, goes all the way back to the 1830s. And so I guess it's kind of astonishing that turf has been with us for so long. But when did this really become sort of a status symbol for the middle class?
I would say in the 20th century, probably after World War I. But I don't really have any data on that. But that's my impression that, you know, in the 1800s, yes, there were people that had push mowers and had lawns, but it became more and more popular. And by 1950, everybody had a lawn.
All right, listeners, remember, we want to hear from you, your feelings about your yard. How important is it to you? Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or post on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange, all one word. Or, of course, as always, you can give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. We have a listener from Lee who has already written in saying, "We let our lawn go unmowed for weeks. Dozens of vibrant patches of daisies and yellow flowers sprang up, some patches 3 feet across and 2 feet tall. It was completely beautiful. And to think those daisies may have been there the whole time and were dutifully mowing them down every week." So Henry, I'm curious, for those who are interested in another way, what would you recommend as sort of a starting point?
I would recommend that if you want to have a flower garden that is sort of a field of beautiful yellow and blue flowers, that you start small. Start with something that's 10 feet by 12 feet or a half moon or something that you can start out and actually dig out the existing lawn. Take a shovel or an edger and cut 1 foot squares and then pry it out with a hand tool such as the Cobra Head Weeder, which is a great hand weeding tool shaped like a bent finger. And once you've got your turf cleared out, then you can plant things. And I have to say that there are wildflower mixes that are available on the market, and they're generally a disappointment. The first year, and I've done them, you get a wide variety of flowers, and it's really quite dramatic. But two or three types of flowers will dominate in following years and until you have just black-eyed Susans, for example, or something else. Now, maybe that's fine. But rather than saying, I'm going to take a rototiller and clear my whole lawn, I'm just going to rototill it in. First of all, it doesn't work. When you rototill grass in, it comes back, and it'll just be aggravated with you for disrupting its life.
So then,
you have to dig the grasses out if you're going to start a flower meadow.
Right. Well, so, and this is where I want to jump in, because I think a lot of people who might find this idea appealing, it is less so for the aesthetics of a beautiful flower patch and more so for the labor savings. And that sounds like a fairly, time-intensive procedure that you're laying out.
Yes, I recommend that people try to do it 30 minutes a day for a few weeks. You know, rather than spending 1 weekend getting blisters and trying to do 8 or 10 hours in a day. Plan it well ahead of time. Do your homework. Read up. Buy books. Join a garden club. Talk to master gardeners or neighbors who have lots of experience. But if you want to have flowers instead of lawn, you probably do best by planting plants that you buy at a nursery rather than trying to do a wildflower mix.
And are we talking about perennials here, things that will come back year after year, or are we talking about a space that you will plant with new plants every summer?
No, perennials. That's the way to go.
Right.
Once they're established, most of them will spread. Some of them will drop seeds. And, you know, lupin, for example, is lovely, and it produces lots of seeds. It will spread with time. On the other hand, once the lupin has finished blossoming, it tends to get scraggly looking and often covered with aphids and is not an ideal plant to have on your lawn all summer. So that's why I say do your homework. Talk to people. Find out what plants will do well in your neighborhood, in your climatic zone, with your soil type. Buy things that are hardy enough to go through a 20 below winter or a 25 below if you're in a cold spot. You have to do all that homework. You can't just throw some things in and expect it to be perfect.
All right. We already have callers who would like to talk more about this. We're going to go first to Stefan in Concord. Stefan, you're on the exchange. What do you have to say about lawns?
Good morning. I moved into a house in Concord about 30 years ago, and it was both front and back or traditional clipped lawn. And now it looks nothing like that. And the way to get to where we are now is no pesticides at all on our property. We use compost and organic materials. We've changed much in terms of planting. Much of what the gentleman that was on before makes all sorts of sense. A lot of perennials. You can put in either bird baths or water features, so you have water available for animals, and planted from small fruits like blueberries and raspberries to apple trees, plum trees, and actually a walnut tree that started to bear. And you bring all of those. It helps you with retaining water on your property. So especially in a year like now, a lot of plants fail because there's not enough water.
Stefan, I'm curious, as someone who started with a very large traditional lawn and has transitioned to something else, do you think that what you have done has saved you time?
Yes, absolutely. Well, it depends on if you speak with me or my wife. That's sort of a... See, that's mostly a joyful experience for me, and weeding is not for her. But
gotcha.
I think if you honestly added it up, and again, the gentleman before said, don't try to do it all in 2 days.
Right.
If you just do some of it all, you know, regularly and read up, you know, so you're not planting something that doesn't belong here.
Right. So
Stefan, I love what you've done, and I congratulate you on taking it on 30 years ago when very few people were doing that. I also would like to underline what you mentioned about planting fruits and flowering trees and shrubs. They will save you time because they take up space. They're wonderful for birds, for the bees, for pollinators of all kinds, and small animals. A crab apple or an apple tree produces a lot of food that you're not going to necessarily eat, but the wildlife will. And that's important, particularly as we make towns more into cities and population density closer. We need to have oases such as yours, Stefan, that allow the animals to survive as well.
Now, Henry, I'd like to stop here for a moment, 10 minutes in, and maybe can we give lawns their due a little bit? So I mentioned at the top that we haven't planted grass at our home, but the other day, so we have a 2-year-old, and the other day we visited a public space that has that sort of very luxurious green soft grass, and that toddler, in the space of a half an hour of hanging out there, taught himself how to do a somersault. So, I mean, you know, grass can be pretty great.
Absolutely. I have grass as well as gardens.
And so I guess the question is here, what's the balance that you think that is out of whack in American landscape design?
I think that what's out of whack is when you have a house sitting on nothing but lawn, and you might have an acre of lawn or half an acre of lawn, and you have a mowing machine that you sit on and you drive around and you cut the lawn twice a week. That's not necessary. Yes, a little bit of lawn for your 2-year-old or for your 18-year-old who wants to play Frisbee. I think it's a nice thing.
So Nancy emails us and asks, is there some type of grass that does not require mowing, one that gets to be a certain length and then just lays over? Any thoughts there, Henry?
Yes, there are such things. I was just this morning talking to somebody from Seedway, which is a commercial company that sells seeds to farmers and landscapers and so forth. And they have something called the OVM mixture, which is orchards, vineyards, and nurseries. And it's a slow-growing two types of grass, a fescue and a perennial rye. And it's dwarf perennial rye. It's slow-growing, and I visited a home just last week in Grantham, New Hampshire, that had this type of turf planted by seed, and it was very attractive. And then the grass hadn't been mowed in 6 weeks. It was flopping over, but it was green, and it was soft on the feet, and your 2-year-old would be happy with it, but it did not require mowing. She said they mow 2 or 3 times a year.
All right, so we're going to hear from Ellen now, who's calling us from Dover. Ellen, you're on the Exchange. What do you have to say about your yard?
Hi, good morning. So I'm a beekeeper in Dover, New Hampshire, and I have heard this conversation a lot more recently, which has been so encouraging. So we have a lot of clover and dandelions, and I'm looking outside right now, and I see buttercups. And I can see so much activity on the lawn, which is just such a great thing for, you know, all the local pollinators. So I feel like a lot of the green lawns are such a food desert, whereas, like, lawns like this have so much to offer to the environment, the local insects, and, you know, by putting in a pollinator garden, it can be so beneficial. We see bumblebees and longhorn bees and everything, so...
Henry, to Ellen's point, what are some good plantings that one can put in for pollinators? And I just an aside, we have a bunch of thyme that we planted in lieu of grass because it grows low and can be stepped on a bunch and survive, and it has been covered in bees this summer. So that's one that I can offer up.
That's true, and that's about the only one that you can walk on. Most plants other than grass do not want to be walked on. And quite frankly, if your two-year-old is doing somersaults in thyme, he's going to get stung. But I like Dutch white clover is wonderful. Instead of buying a Kentucky bluegrass mix, if people are going to plant a lawn, get a conservation mix. And that'll include clover in addition to ryegrass, fescue, and other turf grasses. If you go a couple of weeks, clover will bloom, you know, a couple of weeks between mowing. Clover will bloom, and it will be just full of bees and other pollinators. So if you don't mow when you see whether it's dandelions or which early on are great supporters of our bees, I never understand why people are so anti-dandelion. I think they're great.
Well, so on that point, I'd like to bring in another voice to the conversation right now, Susanna Lerman, who is a research ecologist with the Northern Research Station of the U.S. Department of Agriculture. So, Susanna, you, in fact, have researched this very topic, and it's, I think, sort of like this idea light, which is to say if one just simply mows less frequently, you can have some of the same benefits of letting your grass go wild.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And so kind of building on what Henry was talking about and what your last caller mentioned in terms of planting pollinator gardens, for those of us who don't have the time, the money, or the green thumb, we can just mow our lawns less and yes, let those dandelions and clovers come up. And so I've done some research to really see whether or not that actually makes a difference in terms of pollinator, like does it attract pollinators? And lo and behold, it does. And so here's another opportunity that we can make to make our lawns what I like to think of as less bad by doing less.
So, Susanna, when you say mow less, how much less are we talking about?
So it was really fun. We designed a study, an experiment, to see what happens if you mow your lawn every week, every 2 weeks, and every 3 weeks. And we used those three different frequencies to really mimic what was kind of the norm. So most people, I think, feel that they need to mow every week. And then there's those of us who just are like, oh, I have to go out and mow. And those are kind of a three-week conditions. And so really trying to figure out how bees would respond to these different types. And what we found was that as you mow your lawn less, lo and behold, you have more lawn flowers, these what we call these spontaneous flowers. Some people might think of them as weeds, but like the dandelions and the clover and the creeping Charlie. But what we found in terms of how bees were responding was that mowing every 2 weeks is really that hot spot. And so that's when we're seeing the most numbers of bees that are visiting these lawn flowers. And so when you think about, I think, Sam, you mentioned this earlier in terms of having these spaces looking nice, the 2 weeks is really, I think, kind of a nice balance of really trying to, one, provide habitat for bees and other pollinators, but it also looked nice. It was still acceptable for the neighbors. So most likely your neighbors are not going to complain that your yard looks messy at that 2 week mowing frequency.
So, Susanna, as someone who grew up with mowing the lawn every week as the chore that my parents assigned to me, I have a hard time imagining why anyone would object to the idea that they should mow every 2 weeks. So what are the types of objections? You know, what are the things that compel people to make their yard look like they're trying to maintain Fenway Park?
Right. No, and that's exactly it. And I got to say that this is the one study that I've had so many people thank me for giving them that, you know, that pass of like, oh, you know, I think I've saved marriages, saved, you know, family relationships because of this, of giving people that opportunity to be this, what we call the lazy lawnmower. But I think there are a lot of concerns. And I think because, you know, since the 1950s, people have just kind of bought into the idea that we do need to mow every week, that it is a weekly chore. And so I think it's just ingrained in us. But another issue, and this was something that came up when I was designing this study and I was you know, sharing what I was going to be doing, is the concern about ticks. And so for anybody living in the Northeast, Lyme disease is a huge issue.
And sorry to jump in on you here. We actually have a listener email on this point. It's that Avery emails and says, I would love to not mow the lawns around the house, but ticks make that luxury impossible. Sadly, it becomes a health and welfare issue. So you've studied exactly this. Is that correct?
I did. And so, you know, fortunately, it's one of those things when you design these studies, you always, like, at the end of it, you're like, oh, I wish I had done this. And fortunately, I thought, okay, well, let's see what the tick issue is. And so the study was conducted in Springfield, Massachusetts. So it's the third largest city in the state. And there are definitely ticks, and Lyme disease is extremely prevalent in this area. But what we did was that we monitored to see whether or not ticks were more abundant in the different lawn mowing frequencies, with the idea that mowing every 3 weeks is going to have much taller grasses. And so what we found over the course of 2 years, and I think it was over 200 different surveys, we found zero ticks in the lawn. And so this was really exciting for us, but it was also no data. And so we kind of sat on it for a while. And then in 2019 or 2018, Consumer Reports came out with an article about this very question about how to tick-proof your lawn. And their number one recommendation was to mow short and to mow frequently.
We've got to take a quick break here. We will talk more about rewilding your lawn after a break. Coming up, how to make your backyard less of a chore, more welcoming to bugs and birds. If you have questions, give us a call, 1-800-892-6477, or email us at exchange@nhpr.org.
Not only are we proud to support NHPR, but the return on our investment seems to be paying off as well.
Corey Snow is co-owner of Monadnock Oil & Vinegar in Peterborough and an underwriter of NHPR.
We chose NHPR partly because I'm a huge listener myself, and the feedback we've been getting since we started supporting NHPR has been fantastic. We're getting more people coming into the store and saying, hey, we heard you while we were listening to the radio the other day.
Learn more about growing your business with NHPR's statewide audience at nhpr.org/underwrite.
Welcome back to The Exchange. Today we are talking about rewilding your lawn in a trend on The Exchange where I am hauled out of the woods to guest host to evangelize for things I'm already doing in my own personal life. Today we're destigmatizing the weedy front yard. Right now we're talking to Susanna Lerman, a research ecologist with the Northern Research Station at the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Susanna, you were talking before the break about ticks and a study that you all had done, and I wanted to let you finish that thought.
Thing. Yeah. So the big point that we made in the study is that the context matters. So if you live in a neighborhood that's surrounded by lawns and very little forest around, chances are the tick population isn't that prevalent and that large. And that the other thing is that when ticks are present in our yard, they tend to like the kind of the scraggly bits, the forest fragments on the edges of our yard, like the stone walls. They don't like to be in the lawns that much. And that's exactly what we found in our study in Springfield.
Indeed. Didn't I read that it was the leaf litter where you could really find a lot of ticks?
Exactly. So again, that tends to not be on your lawn. So if you choose to mow your lawn less frequently so that you can support bees and other pollinators, what our study has shown is that that's not going to be an invitation for more ticks.
All right, we're going to take a call now from Bob in Contoocook. Bob, you're on The Exchange. What do you have to say?
Yes, good morning. One thing I wanted to start out with, one of our obsessions with big expansive lawns goes back to a long time. If you think about the big plantations and big, huge farms, they would take large areas out of crop to show just how wealthy they were and put them into these expansive lawns. So that's one reason that people, that, you know, we have that as a cultural norm. But what I have done, I had a crappy lawn, you know, a lot of weeds and stuff like that. And I finally, one spring, decided I'm going to leave it. and I get all these weeds, quote, weeds, they're all wildflowers. And it brings an enormous number of different pollinators. And, of course, the dandelions and all that are nice and early. So I don't mow my lawn except maybe two or three times a year. Sometimes what I have to do is go out with my cordless weed whacker, knock down the foot-tall grass just to not let it turn into a hay field. But I don't have a manicured lawn anymore, and I really enjoy it. And it's funny, my wife has to wear her shoes out when she's hanging the laundry because she occasionally will step on a bee because there's so much. What I've done is put like clover in when I've had a bare spot and that sort of thing. So it's a really neat thing. I've got hundreds of asters, the summer asters all throughout the yard, that sort of thing.
Well, and Susanna, I wonder if we can speak to people whose experience, like Bob is being expressed, and perhaps to some as well who for instance, we have an email from Robin in Epsom who says, I have a large lawn that I've been reducing slowly by making pollinator beds, and I really want to get rid of my lawn except for a small play area with my dog. Unfortunately, my husband loves his lawn, trying hard to compromise. And then we have Mike in Londonderry who says, I don't think I can commit to eliminating my lawnmower, but I've been mowing less, letting the natural flowers, the flowering plants grow where they will. Any ideas? So what can we say here as sort of the folks who are on the continuum of lawn care? Like how many folks out there would you estimate are more like Bob, and how many really, really are trying to have that very manicured look?
Yeah, that's a great question. And thank you for doing what you're doing. I think what you're providing some really great habitat for bees. And I think what I realized throughout this study is that I think there's three different types of people. There's the what I call the lawn people, and these are the folks that are just absolutely obsessed with their lawn. They're going to have their golf course manicured. It's going to be mowed at least once, if not twice a week. Those people, I don't feel like we're going to be able to change their minds. Then there's the other side of the spectrum, and Sam, it sounds like you fit into this category of folks who, you know, just kind of let their lawn go and will mow it occasionally just to appease their neighbors if that's important.
The radical fringe.
But then there's the group in the middle that don't really know exactly what they're supposed to do, but they see their neighbor mowing every week and they figure, I guess that's what I'm supposed to do as well. And rather than doing the research, they're just going to follow what they're doing and really try to keep up with those neighborhood norms, like keeping up with the Joneses. And so I think it's that group of people that, you know, I think the stories that we're hearing today and also the research that I've been working on for the last couple of years, I think this can really help inform them to help them change the way that they're managing their lawns.
Susanna, I'm curious, given your research, what you personally do with the patch around where you live?
Oh, gosh, our yard is a complete mess. but, you know, we mow, you know, every two or three weeks when we get around to it and when the mower is not broken. And so I think, you know, the reason I conducted this research, you know, as well was just to give myself a pass. But we also have a bunch of wildlife friendly types of plantings that the previous owners had planted, but I have no clue how to maintain them. And they're, every year, I think another plant slowly dies. And so I get the need to have lawns because they're really easy to maintain. Like, you know, yes, you have to mow them every couple of weeks, but it doesn't take any special skill. It doesn't take a special desire to want to be out and to be a gardener. And so, again, I feel like this is just another opportunity for people to manage their lawns in a way that's, you know, a lot more wildlife friendly.
Susanna, I'm curious, with regards to the pressure from neighbors to keep the lawn looking quote-unquote nice, I remember my parents had a field that they used to let grow wild, and they got a sort of pointed letter from the local garden club about it. What are some ways that one might combat that pressure? And I'm personally thinking of signs I have seen about the sort of intentionality of letting grass grow long.
That's exactly it. And so when we were conducting this study, we placed signs in all of our study lawns to let the neighbors know that, nope, the yard wasn't just being let go, that it was part of science. But then after the study got published, we designed lawn signs that people could download for free on the Forest Service website to let people know that it is intentional. And so, again, I think making sure that your neighbors know that it's not neglected, but there is that intentionality, I think can really go a long way.
All right. Susanna Lerman from the research ecologist with the Northern Research Station of the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Thank you so much for being with us, Susanna.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Listeners, as always, we want to hear from you. Do you love mowing your lawn? And does this very conversation make you grind your teeth? Tell us why. Or have you been experimenting with a slightly less grassy yardscape? And how's that going? Our number is 1-800-892-6477. Email us at exchange or at nhpr.org. Or, of course, you can reach us on social media as well. Henry Hohmeyer, I'd like to bring you back into the conversation here. Tom writes us and says, we have an 8,000-square-foot area, which started as a wildflower mix, but now is dominated by purple lupines and very little else. The lupins look awesome when they're flowering, but it would be nice to have other flowers and color in that area. Do you have any wildflowers you'd recommend to help add color to that area? And I want to just sort of piggyback on here that the idea of specific plantings that you have to maintain, for me personally as a homeowner, just sounds like more gardening. And what I want is something that I can ignore.
Well, yes, there are a number of things I could recommend. If he's got lupins, then black-eyed Susans would do well in the same soil and sun conditions. And you can go about this a number of different ways. You can buy a packet of seeds and start your seeds indoors or on a table outside, water them daily in a planting mix until they're a couple inches tall, and then plant them in the garden or in that space, pulling aside anything else that's growing there and giving them a clean spot to go into. A wonderful wildflower is Queen Anne's lace, which would also grow where lupins grow. I'm assuming that he has a fairly sandy, sunny spot. There are three types of soil: sandy soil, clay soil, and a good loam. We all want a good loam, but nobody ever gets it without some considerable amount of work and adding compost and so forth. But if you've got a sandy soil, those are a few things that work well there. Gay feather or liatris, which is a tall, spiky thing, is blooming right now. You want to have something for each different season because the lupins are early in the summer. You want some New England asters, perhaps. You can go to a garden center and buy a pot of New England asters and plunk it in the ground, and it should survive and thrive. And it's a wonderful plant for pollinators in the fall.
Melanie in Lebanon writes in, I wonder if someone could offer advice on what to do with large lawns over septic areas. I've been told that we can't plant anything but grass there because it would interfere with our septic field. It's a lot of lawn, and I'd like to reduce it if possible. Henry, do you have any thoughts about septic areas and what are suitable plantings to go over them?
That's a problem because the people that install septic systems are very firm about lawn only. I have a brother-in-law up in Canada who emailed me recently saying that the town had come to him and said, you've planted willows over the septic system. That's not acceptable. Well, that probably isn't a very good idea because willows will really search for water, and they may get into the leach field and cause problems. I don't know. I design gardens for people. And I don't do anything but grass over leach fields, and I probably need to do more research on that because I'm sure there are plenty of things that don't have deep roots and would be acceptable, but I need to know what the law is on that too because there may be regulations that the septic people are actually following.
All right. We are going to go to take a caller here. Jamie in New Boston is on the line. Jamie, you're on the exchange. What do you have to say?
Great. Hi, Sam, and hello to your caller. This is so interesting, and I've been in and out because I'm in the car with both hands on the wheel and had to answer a telephone call. But I did hear the part about Queen Anne's lace. Just gorgeous. There's this field in New Boston across from a household. It's just packed with Queen Anne's lace. It's gorgeous. I remember years ago seeing a field full of daisies, so people obviously did something intentional there. I remember a few years ago somebody told me that the state is selling, or they were anyway, like for $10 a pound, you get this flour mixture. It has rutabaga in it and a bunch of other things. And you know, they put it on the state road. So I have a question about that. And then finally, the reason I mow our lawn is because we have poison ivy encroaching in. And if I don't keep that grass, if I don't keep it mowed, that poison ivy comes in more and more every year.
So Henry, thoughts about, first of all, I do remember the story about the Department of Transportation accidentally planting wildflower mix in the median and it causing a problem because so many cars were stopping to look at the beautiful flowers that were really very dramatic. But thoughts about, poison ivy, things to do about poison ivy. But I also wonder, there are also things like zoning laws or homeowners association rules that require cutting of grass. And if you have had any experience with those in terms of ways to sort of perhaps convince your neighbors that you're on the right track.
Well, I think that the idea of putting up signs saying this is an experimental plot following recommendations from the USDA about mowing, it will certainly reduce the call from the cranky neighbor. You may still get calls, but at least they know you're not just being lazy.
In terms of poison ivy, thoughts about poison ivy and ways to combat it?
It's a real pest, and I agree that mowing it to keep it from spreading probably makes sense. But maybe you can do a border around an area right at the edge of your forest where the poison ivy is coming from. Do a 3-foot or 4-foot band where you cut it every week and then leave the middle portion to grow longer and see if that works.
All right. We are going to head to a quick break. When we come back, we're going to be talking about more alternatives to the traditional lawn, and we want to hear from you about your lawn care regime or lack thereof. Do you dread mowing the grass and long to convert some of your turf into something more productive? Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or call 1-800-892-6477. This is The Exchange. I'm Sam Evans Brown. This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Sam Evans Brown, filling in for Laura Knoy. Today, lawns, or rather, getting rid of them. Rather than trying to make your home look like the grounds of Duke Wellington's estate, how to choose an alternative school of landscaping. We've got another voice with us now, Thomas Rayner, landscape architect and author of several books on this subject. Thomas, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So I'm curious, for folks who are interested in heading in this direction, but maybe are afraid of the, sort of censorious neighbor who's peering out from behind the blinds across the way, mm-hmm. Any thoughts about how to do this type of thing in a way that's attractive that maybe we haven't heard yet on the show?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think understanding how to create usable lawns, I think one of the problems with the American suburban lawn is, many people have said, is kind of done as the default treatment over in the entire yard. In many ways, Americans treat lawns the way that houses in the 1970s treated carpet, done a wall-to-wall carpeting. Remember in the 70s we had carpets in our bathrooms and kind of everywhere. And I think, instead of thinking of a lawn more like an area rug rather than wall-to-wall carpeting, by that, I mean kind of a smaller, more defined lawn, perhaps in front of the house where the neighbors see it the most. And then using all that extra space where the lawn doesn't want to grow, those areas where it bleeds out under the trees or next to fences or kind of against the woodland edge, replacing lawn in those areas with lush biodiverse planting. And in that way, you get a lawn that's right sized and looks more like a terrace. You know, it can be very beautifully defined by planting or things around it. And then still have a little piece that makes the neighbors, happy. So to me, I think it's about a compromise. It doesn't have to be about abandoning lawn.
So Thomas, you work ecological horticulture at Phyto Studio. You authored the book Planting in a Post-Wild World, and I think that sort of speaks to what I'm hearing, which is that this is not necessarily just about letting things completely go wild, but also actually doing some planting and encouraging of things that might do well in the place.
That's
that
right.
Okay. So sorry. Say more about that.
Yeah, so we're really interested in kind of the hybrid between the world of ecology and the world of traditional horticulture. Horticulture, for I think too long, has been focused on kind of plants as individual objects, these ornamental divas kind of set in a sea of mulch. And instead, we really want to replace that idea of planting as a biodiverse system, as 3 to 10 species in a bed that are multiple layers. And we really think about building ground cover. We think about plants as mulch, as a replacement to the enormous amount of bark mulch that's used in the United States every single year, which is a huge problem in terms of carbon. Most of the mulch we put onto our soils, not that mulch is all bad, but a lot of that mulch off-gases the carbon into the atmosphere, very little back to the soil. And the best way to get more carbon into the soil is through plant roots. And so a lot of what we focus on in the book is to teach people how to build ground cover. And so this means looking at a plant's body language. For example, the last guest talked about black-eyed Susans or lupines, these tall perennials that grow in a garden. But if you look at where they grow in the wild, they never grow by themselves. There's always plants underneath these taller, upright plants that are very often have naked feet underneath them. And so we're really focused on helping people to lower the maintenance in their garden beds by replacing mulch with things like violets or greens and golds and golden groundsels, and a whole range of native ground covers that really the whole purpose is to create more stability and reduce labor.
Adam in Dunbarton writes, New Hampshire needs more lavender. Replace your lawn with a hardy variety like Phenomenal, excellent for bees and butterflies, drought tolerant, insect / deer repellent, beautiful, full sun, fragrant, and cash crop if you're so inclined. Kathleen in Bow says she's looking for more information about food plants for butterflies. Butterfly food, also called host plants, very important to continue the life cycle of butterflies and moths. I'm curious, Thomas, thoughts about these calls. When you talk about replacing mulch, which I'm really glad you brought up, because I think a lot of people, when they don't want to grow grass, mulch is sort of the go-to solution. Mm-hmm. What kinds of plants are we actually talking about in a place like New Hampshire?
So we're thinking about plants that are typically very low. They're typically a bit shade tolerant because a lot of these plants are going to be grown underneath shrubs and tall, you know, those lupines and black-eyed Susans, those kind of taller, more charismatic plants. So these include things like sedges. There's a whole range of kind of low, short grasses called sedges, many of which are somewhat winter present. They include plants like violets. You've seen violets in lawn. And talking about a wonderful larval host plant for lots of different Lepidoptera, you know, bird, butterfly, and moth species. That is just a remarkable one. All kinds of plants like golden groundsel, which is a low horizontally spreading. These are rhizomatous plants. And so a big thing of what we encourage people to do is to have 2 or 3 basic types of ground cover in a planting bed and then just kind of to randomly mix them. It might be something low and clumping like a sedge with a leafy plant like an asterum or a green and gold or something that spreads rhizomatously. And all of these plants, they're a little bit aggressive, but when a plant is aggressive and 8 inches tall, you know, we tend to welcome that kind of aggressiveness. When it's 7 feet tall and aggressive, it becomes really a bit of a problem. So, you know, embracing kind of these clonal spreading behaviors for plants that'll spread around and intermingle and form a dense thatch that can grow underneath our azaleas or our rhododendrons or some of those bigger plants we have in our garden.
Denise in Keene is on the line. Denise, you're on the exchange. What are you doing in your yard?
Hi. Well, thanks so much for giving me the chance to speak to this, because the lawn at my house, fortunately, we have two very tolerant neighbors who deal with the fact that we mow, perhaps mow is not the right word, but we cut the grass about twice a year. By and large, lots and lots of wildflowers. And the reason I wanted to call is because my son has taught us to use a sai, the tool that's, you know, sort of traditional for cutting, like wheat. You would see the Grim Reaper carrying a sai. We don't wear black when we use it, but but you know, we cut the grass with the sai, and it's wonderful. It's actually been a really beautiful thing in our family because it's really quiet. There's no fossil fuels. It's good exercise. You're out and spend some time really in among the wildflowers, and it creates mulch that we then use in our garden beds. So I wanted to share, like, how far out on the spectrum.
It's very interesting that you say that, Denise, because as we heard at the top of the show, that's where lawns had their start, is with, you know, sort of grand estates in Europe and gardeners hand-scything down the grass. So Thomas, I'm curious, thoughts about scything?
Well, I've never done that, but I love the idea and love, you know, kind of the meditative connection. You're doing a different kind of practice that engages people and, you know, slowing down and seeing things. I think it's wonderful. You know, not every place probably can get away with that, but I think it's wonderful to kind of push the boundaries on what we can do and how to make it look good.
Well, so and real quick, one of the points that she made, which I wonder if we could unpack here, is that she mentioned it was an idea that her son brought to the family. And I guess, yeah. Is this a trend where you're seeing younger folks who are perhaps concerned about climate change and have a different conception of what home ownership means might have different ideas about what looks good?
Absolutely. We are seeing a generational change in an approach to horticulture. I think the as garden clubs and many of the traditional kind of suburban lawn, or the kind of the bastion of horticulture and growing has been in the American suburban lawn, is now shifting to millennials who don't have houses and who are much more open to new and different approaches. I think we're really at the beginning of a generational change in rethinking how ecology and horticulture can work in small suburban and urban plots.
And Henry Hohmeyer, I'm curious to hear from you as well. You've been writing and working in New England gardening for a long time. Are you seeing that here in New England, which is, you know, a place that's fairly staid, fairly traditional?
Yes, within limits. So going back to scything, I have a scythe. My grandfather was a fantastic scyther. It's hard to do, even if you're good at it. You have to carry a whetstone in your back pocket, and you have to sharpen your scythe. If you're scything for an hour, you will have sharpened once or twice. Hmm. The weed whacker, and particularly if you get a battery-operated weed whacker, which are readily available with 24-volt batteries, that has replaced the scythe. I don't think even millennials will use the scythe because it's hard work and it takes a great skill to make everything come out at the same height. My grandfather could do it. I never mastered that. I can cut down a field with a scythe, but if I had to do it, I would probably use my battery-powered weed whacker.
Okay, so let's talk more then about this generational shift. What are you two seeing in terms of ways that norms and values are shifting? What are the types of landscape designs that are becoming more popular as folks are becoming more critical of you know, the sod, of turf? And I'd like to throw this to you first, Thomas.
We are landscape architects, and we do a lot of public sector work. And one of the most fascinating changes in the last 10 years is what I call the Highline Effect. Having, like, for example, a mayor in Fredericksburg, Virginia, asking for a public park to have their version of the Highline. And by that, he really meant that the plant, you know, this kind of celebratory planting that was lush and more biodiverse and more kind of local, being a big part of the experience of the park. And I think that's really wonderful when you have kind of a project like that really inspiring other areas of the country to embrace more ecological horticulture, more inventive and innovative public planting that are
are not only more biodiverse, but also more colorful and very exciting. I mean, the High Line has changed real estate values in New York City. You know, many people complain about that, but you know, it's really exciting to think about how exciting horticulture and public space can do that. And so I think we're seeing more and more people wanting a piece of that action.
Henry, you mentioned when we spoke to you before the show that you've recently been involved in a project converting lawn into something else. What was that project, and what did you all do?
It was a homeowner in Grantham, New Hampshire, who did not like having to mow the lawn, didn't like the look of lawn, wanted to have a field of garden of flowers. And we hired young people in, you know, their late teens to come and work with us to remove the grass first and the weeds that were there, and then planted specific plants that were good in a hot, dry location, similar to the High Line. I just wanted to clarify, the High Line is 2 miles of elevated railway line abandoned in New York City that's been converted into the number one tourist attraction of New York City now. People come from all over the world to walk this 2 miles. I've done it. It's lovely. It was designed by a Dutchman, Pete Udolf. And part of the garden that we planted was based on Pete Udolf's use of decorative grasses and wildflowers that supported pollinators. So it's only in its second year. It's looking lovely. It does take maintenance. This is not a work-free environment. And getting a garden like that established means you have to water in a dry summer like this one, which is a problem because water restrictions are now in effect in that part of the town.
Taya in New London writes in, when we purchased our house, we inherited a large area of our even larger lawn that was planted with crocus and daffodils. We decided to let that area grow out after blooming. I just had it mowed, but will not mow again until November and leave the clippings through winter. Everyone loves the spring blooms, but I'm sure some neighbors think us odd, but I have fireflies, butterflies, birds, bugs, and snakes, even deer bed down in the long grass. Thomas, thoughts about this in terms of wildlife benefits? I mean, I personally have noticed that we have a ton of birds in our front yard, many more than spots where it's just green grass.
Yeah, I love that idea of a bulb lawn. I think that's another one of those ways of adjusting an existing lawn. We're actually planting some in Arlington National Cemetery for a future project. And this just the idea of taking some naturalizing early season bulbs like crocuses or species daffodils, both of which can be really good for early season pollinators, and planting them into an existing lawn. And then you let, you know, they're very short. They bloom kind of in the spring, and then you do kind of late spring, early summer cut. And then you can go back to resuming mowing your lawn as normal. But you, at least for that spring season, you get all that wonderful color and a lot more benefit for pollinators.
Bernie tweets in with this question. I tested part of my lawn, let it grow out for a full summer, but just Norway maple saplings and clumpy long grass. How does one achieve that wildflower meadow without installing it? Henry, you mentioned that these landscapes do still take maintenance. I'm curious, when we're talking about maintenance, apart from watering, what are we talking about if it's not, you know, weekly mowings?
Pulling out those Norway maples and other invasive seedlings is very important. And that takes time.
Yeah.
Person power.
So I'm thinking of our little patch. What we do is we cut it once a year. Usually in the spring, we'll head out with like a brush hog and take down all the woody growth. Do you think we're on the right track, or is that, should we be doing something different?
No, it sounds like you're doing a wonderful job with it, and I'd like to come visit it sometime. And write an article about it. I write a weekly gardening column 52 weeks out of the year. And next winter, when I've got nothing else to write about, I'm going to write about Sam's lawn turned into a wonderful pollinator space. So I'd like to come
Well, we can connect afterward, but we've got limited time left, so I want to give the last word to you, Thomas. For folks who are interested in heading down this road and trying to find some resources, where would you send them? What should they read? Who should they be reaching out to if they're interested in changing up their yardscape?
There are some wonderful resources. Our book, to be shameless, Planting in the Postwild World. There's Larry Wiener has a book out called Garden Revolution. I think a wonderful kind of primer on some alternatives. There's other resources in terms of books. We love nurseries like New Moon Nursery and North Creek Nursery's website because they have a really curated list of species that are good alternatives in planting beds. So those are some good starting points.
All right. Thank you so much, both of you, for taking the time to be with us. Henry Hohmeyer, a longtime gardening columnist, author of 4 gardening books here in New England. Thank you, Henry.
Thank you for having me. It was great fun.
And Thomas Rayner, landscape architect, also author of Planting in the Postwild World. Thank you, Thomas, for being here.
Thanks for having me.
That is it for today. Thank you all for calling in and for writing in. Our show's producers are Jessica Hunt, Christina Phillips, and our fellow is Jane Vaughn. Senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Michael Brindley is our program manager. Our regular theme music was composed by Bob Lord. Our engineer, very patiently today, Dan Colgan. Remember, this conversation continues online on Facebook and at nhpr.org. I'm Sam Evans Brown. Thanks very much for listening.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.